Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our new virtual exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we dive into the life and work of Maya Angelou with Nikki Giovanni and Glory Edom. Nikki Giovanni is an acclaimed poet, writer, activist, and educator. She is the author of several best-selling collections of poetry and the recipient of numerous well-earned awards and honors. She is currently a university distinguished professor at Virginia Tech. Glory Edom is the founder of Well-Read Black Girl, a book club and a digital platform that promotes Black literature and sisterhood. She is the author of an essay anthology also called Well-Read Black Girl that includes contributions from Tiari Jones, Morgan Jerkins, Jasmine Ward, and more. She won the Innovators Award at the 2017 Los Angeles Times Book Prizes. The two are interviewed by Nate King, Content and Communications Coordinator for the American Writers Museum.
Nikki, Glory, thanks so much for being with me today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for having us. This is so exciting.
Let's get into it. First, I'm curious about how both of you either met Maya Angelou in person or met her through her writing, kind of those first experiences of engaging with her. Nikki, maybe we could start with you.
Oh, I first met Maya in Mount Holyoke. There was a conference going on. Maya was there, Kay Graham, who was the owner of the Washington Post. And I went up with, my mother wanted to go because she'd never seen Mount Holyoke. She always had an affection for it. And I said to Mommy, oh, come on, you know, we'll go up. And what I most remember about that, you know, Maya was tall and Kay Graham was tall. And they both had on fur coats. And my mother had on a cloth coat. And I said to myself, as I looked at Kay and Maya, well, this will never happen again. As soon as I go home, my mother, I'm going to get my mother a fur coat. She's never going to walk in with those two women, and that's what's going to happen. And we were on the program together. Maya was always very nice, as you know, anyway. But we laughed, and later, years later, I happened to mention her. You know how my mother got her fur coat, and I told her about the story. She said, I didn't notice. I said, well, you didn't have to, because I did.
I had the opportunity to read Maya Angelou when I was really young, and I will say I did not understand a word of I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings when I first read it. I was probably maybe 11 or 12 years old, and I think I just was just taken by the language and just how powerful her writing was, and I used to read it out loud to my little brother. And he didn't understand either because he's 5 years younger than me. But there would be these times where I would just like read her book out loud and I would pretend to be her and I would pretend my brother was Bailey. And I had this just affection for her writing and her work. And that really led throughout my whole life. So when I ended up in college, I started tutoring at a school that was named after her. It was called the Maya Angelou Public Charter School in Washington, D.C. So I took that as a sign as like, my connection to her through her books. And she has always just been like a figure in my life. I had an opportunity to meet her when I was at Howard University. She came up to speak and I met her. And I remember I had a disposable camera and I took a photo of her. And she signed a book of poetry that I have. So I have a couple of like signed books from Maya Angelou. And then because of I tutored at the school, they always did a fundraiser every year. They'd have this big a fundraiser and they would come and we would go, again, this is in Washington, D.C. We would go to the Lincoln Theater in D.C. and pay tribute to her and raise money for the school. And so that happened. So I was able to attend that fundraiser 2 years and she was there. And again, I was always really nervous and I like did my bow down to her feet and just gave her so much thanks and gratitude. So my life has had these really special like moments where I've been able to like hold her hand or say thank you and just acknowledge her work. So she holds a really special place in my heart. I didn't get a fur coat though, but I definitely had like my own moments with her.
I love that. That's great. Glory, you mentioned her writing and how it kind of captivated you. What about it specifically, if you could
I mean, there's so many things. I feel like before I read her work, I hadn't really read any like autobiographies by Black women. I had only read the narrative of Frederick Douglass in school, or I had like these like grand ideas of like Martin Luther King or Malcolm X. I had never really read a story by a Black woman. And the fact that she wrote her sentences so like freeing, like reading her work feels like you're listening to a conversation, like someone's sitting next to you and they're telling you a secret. And that gave me a lot of freedom to own my own voice and talk the way I wanted to talk and not feel limited by like syntax and grammar or whatever it is. Like I was like, I can just be open and free and just experiment with language. And she was the first person to really introduce that to me. And also there felt like, when I read her work, I feel so much emotion, you know, like it didn't feel like this academic text where I was like studying it word for word in terms of trying to memorize it and kind of pass a test. I was like reading someone's life and this person was being honest and vulnerable. And in turn, I could be honest and vulnerable and like be open. So that she really was the first person to give me that freedom. And it, again, when I was reading it so young, I don't think I understood that. It wasn't until I read it again at 16 and then again at 22. And you know, even when I recently became a new mother, and when that happened, I went back to her work too to see how she raised her son. I have a little boy. And so I'm constantly revisiting her work for that connection. And now I have the pleasure of listening to her voice too. I love listening to like audiobooks, and her listening to Maya Angelou read something is just like, it's just like honey in the ear. It's like so beautiful and smooth, and just her voice is, I think that's what I miss the most. I mean, we're so thankful to have audio recordings. We can hear her, we can watch her on YouTube, but hearing her in person give a speech and just like hearing her laughter, it is just, it really changes your heart and it moves you. And I imagine Nikki Giovanni has like, so like, can you tell us what it was like to like hear her voice or talk to her in person? Like that must've been just such a joy.
Well, we became friends. I didn't have the fur coat either. I bought one for my mother, by the way, just to be clear for the people who care about fur. But every time that Maya saw my mother, wherever she saw her, she was always very kind to her. And Maya and I became friends because I liked the kindness that she showed my mother. And it was just one of those, everybody didn't always do what they should do. They might speak to mommy or something, but she always went out of her way to be kind to mommy. And I always appreciated that. And of course, once I moved to New York, you know, you're going to run into a lot of people. And as you know, you're talking about a son, but as you know, Guy had that horrible accident and, you know, as we speak, is in a wheelchair. And of course, it was clear that Maya read a lot because I know Why the Caged Bird Sing is from Paul Laurence Dunbar. And I spent my life, I grew up in Cincinnati. And of course we had a lot, we knew a lot about Mr. Dunbar and all of us who are poets, including you, Gloria, including people who are coming up. Dunbar is the one who taught us you can earn a living reading poetry. You can be a Black person earning living. And he did that. He bought a house and then he bought the house next door for his mother. So there was this affection that I had for the fact that she had a Dunbar affection. And of course Maya had a great voice. So there's absolutely no question when you say you've heard that voice. She had a great voice and she was an actress. And I think that people didn't realize, I mean, that we know that Maya performed, that she did some in Roots. She was the grandmother. You remember, she's the one who went when, what's his name? Kente was born. She's the grandmother there. And so we have seen her acting ability, and we see it on stage too, because that's one of the things she brings to the poetry that she writes and to the poetry that of other people that she shares. Which I always thought, again, was very kind of her to bring out some of the younger poets to share their work with them. But of course, when she took a job here, it's very funny. I mean, not ha-ha, but Maya accepted a job in Wake Forest. And about that time, I accepted a job at Virginia Tech, which is where I am now. So Wake Forest is only about 2 hours. And so I would drive down and she wasn't doing anything. You know, we would talk to each other. Of course, Maya always thought she was a good cook and I always thought that I was. And so we would have that fight going on, like, oh no, I cook better than you do. And we would have that, you know, no, you know, well, come and try this or come and try that. And so it was a lot of fun because she was my neighbor. And of course, as you know, when Slade died, Toni Morrison's son, I went down and asked Maya, what should we do? Yeah. And what we decided to do, which was really an incredible show, actually, we decided we would ask almost all of the writers that we knew and loved if they would come and read a part of their favorite Toni Morrison. Oh. And it was so wonderful because all of a sudden, Toni is sitting there listening to her words from, you know, 40 writers. And as she said, and I was close to Toni, and as she said, you know, if nothing ever happens to me in my public life, and she already had won a Nobel, she had, you know, won every, she said, if nothing else ever happens, this does it for me. And both of us were so pleased that we could give Toni something, because you lose your child. There's nothing to be, you cannot give back. That's gone, but you can let people know you are loved. And mm-hmm. I think that we did that.
Wow. And that is such a beautiful story. And so what comes to mind is just this idea of collective and community care. The moment, you know, Toni Morrison was in need and needed to be held in such a profound way, you were able to all to come together and make sure that, you know, just remind her how much she is loved and how much you want to help her in this time of just a great despair. It is a beautiful thing to have those memories. Thank you for sharing that. That is amazing. That is so amazing.
Oh, yeah. No, it was a lot of fun. And the first time, though, this is not a part of what you've asked, but the first time that I met, you know, she and Oprah were close. Oprah and I are not what you would call close. You know, we don't dislike her, but we're not close. And we, as I said, we had this fight all the time about who was the best cook, or the better cook, I guess it is. And Oprah was visiting, because Oprah used to visit Maya a lot. If you ever get to talk to her, you know, she was there. And Maya called and said, you know, why don't you come down? You're always bragging about your cooking. Why don't you come down and cook something? And I said, you know, I didn't know what was going on. I said, well, she said, anything you want. And I decided what I was going to cook was a rack of lamb, because I knew that she couldn't, at that point, Maya's going to be in the wheelchair. So she had a professional kitchen, by the way. And if you've never, it was a gas stove, but, you know, it was professional, the whole thing. And so I knew that she could only go so far in her house. And I said, ha, I will cook this rack of lamb, I'll show you. I didn't know that Oprah was going to be there. So I take this rack of lamb. I get my meat from a place called Lobel's. So I took that down, and her people were going to cook the vegetables. And I said, okay, we got it. And I really did make, I have to say, an incredible rack of lamb. And now we've got Oprah, and we had Gail was there, and Maya, you know, and then I realized, oh, I've got a problem maybe. And Maya always sat at the top of her table, just like any other grandmother. So she did, and we cut it. And I looked at it because I knew I had done it. This was the light at the top of the tree. And she looked at me. I said, admit it. Admit that this is the best rack of lamb you ever had. And she tasted, she said, oh, it needs a little salt. I said, girl, you ought to stop it. You ought to quit it. You ought to be ashamed of yourself. We had fun doing some things like that. We really did. And that's how I met Oprah.
Oh my gosh. I actually have one of my favorite books by Maya Angelou. The dedication is, let me see here. It's Wouldn't Take Nothing for My Journey Now. And the book is dedicated to Oprah Winfrey with love. Yeah, she definitely, yeah. That was one of the things that, I do remember like their relationship, because they had like the Legends Ball, and they had like, they had so many moments, public moments, where they were like embracing each other and loving on each other. It is amazing to think about their friendship or just all the friendships in a really regular way. Like the way y'all are going back and forth about the rack of lamb and, you know, just cutting up together, loving on each other. It takes it out of this kind of like, oh my gosh, these incredible, I mean, they are legends without any doubt. You all are iconic women. But the fact is, y'all can still dance together, cook together, laugh together, And it just reminds you that, you know, it's, there's just like a connection that's not just the how much, what am I trying to say? Like, everything just always normal. Feels so, yeah, normal people. Thank you. Normal people.
I can tell you another story that has nothing to do with Maya, but Maya was nice to everybody. And this is a Chicago story, by the way. We all love and recognize the brilliance of Gwendolyn Brooks. But anybody, and Miss Brooks was a friend, but anybody that knows Miss Brooks knows she could not cook. She is one of the few Black women who is an artist who could not cook. And when Gwen would invite you, you know, you'd come to Chicago and Gwen would say, oh, come by the house, you know, we'll have dinner. The first thing you thought was, oh no, because she was the worst cook in the world. You can ask anybody that knows Gwen. We loved her, but she couldn't cook. And that's a fact. And she's one of the few people, as I say, most writers, female writers I know at least, can cook. But Gwen
she gave us so much more.
Indeed. It was, well, she did, but Gwen couldn't cook. We loved her anyway.
Oh, that's man.
Glory, what would you, if given the chance, cook for Ms. Giovanni or Ms. Angela?
Oh, listen, I might be up there with Ms. Gwendolyn Brooks because I can't cook either. I could practice something. My people are from West Africa, so I can make some jollof rice. I can bring some jollof rice to the table, and I think everyone would be, especially if you like a little spice, I can make that happen for you.
That's just really funny because it's all creative. And as I was saying to someone else, you know, I'm not a chef. I'm a Southern cook. And Southern cooks, and this is what Margaret Walker, and Margaret was a dear friend of mine, but Margaret and all the rest of it, my grandmother, Southern cooks take whatever is around. They take whatever's in the pantry, whatever, if it's spring, which it is now. And that's one of the other reasons I was outdoors, because the garden is beginning to come up and my mint is coming up. And so you go out and you pull your mint, you take whatever is available and your family eats it. My grandmother used to have that expression. And we used to tease her about it all the time because she would brag. So if you think I'm bragging, you should know my grandmother. And she would say, well, you know, my family always has two choices. And we would fall for that all the time. And we'd say, what's that, Grandma? What two choices? She'd say, take it or leave it. And that's what we learned about cooking. So if I was with you or if you were there, you would have two choices on the table. And we used to tease Maya about that too. We used to laugh about, you know, well, that's it, you take it or leave it. And of course, Maya's Mississippian, so she had learned that very, very, very early. And again, that food brings everybody, as you know, together. And one of the things that builds friendships is somebody's cooking and somebody is eating. And you have to. I remember when Barack Obama was president, he was running for president, and he went down to New Orleans, and he was at Leah Chase's. I know Gloria might know Leah Chase, you might not, but he was at Leah Chase's, and he sat down and ordered and then made the most incredible mistake. He said, may I have some sauce, some hot sauce, please? And Leah came out of the kitchen. Leah was 80 years old, came out of the kitchen and said, nobody adds to my food. And I'm sure he was like, oh my God. He learned, you know, now you may be Hawaiian, you may be whatever you are, but if you're eating at Leah Chase's, you eat what you're on it. If she puts it on the table, you eat it. And I have to
laugh. Oh my goodness.
Nobody puts touch on my food.
That is amazing. That is amazing. Well, in the spirit of you take it or you leave it, that's like, I feel like that was the theme and the message in her writing, right? So I feel so many people either love and adore, and I think that everyone falls in that category. Most people love and adore her work. And if you don't, you can take it or leave it. You're on the other side because you're not connected to it. You don't understand it. And that's fine. I think that's the beauty of her legacy. Like, she was so clear about who she was, what her intentions was, what her spirit was. And it wasn't about bending or contorting herself to be into any box. And that, like that's another incredible part of her legacy. Like if I, when I was writing my first anthology, I really did like go back and just study her life. I watched her documentary. I reread a lot of her first works, and she had done so much. The fact that like she traveled to West Africa, the fact that she worked with Baldwin and Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, and like she immersed herself, the fact that she was an actress, you know, being in Roots, like all these things. When you think of the idea or theme of being a Renaissance woman, she was that, you know, and it takes so much courage to say, I'm going to do all these things, and some things I'm going to do really well and perfect them and be the best, but also I'm okay with like testing things out and pivoting my life. If that, like, I can change, I can leave God if I don't want to be there anymore. I can go back to San Francisco. I can be in, down south, and I can still be a mother, and I can still, you know, be a writer. And there, I mean, without saying like it wasn't without challenges, like she still did it. And I think that effort is such a like, important thing to note. Like the effort she put into every part of her life is so phenomenal. And on the other side of it, I thought it was effortless, but the reality is like she worked so hard to be the woman she was, you know? I'm sorry. I'm just like having a moment. Cause I'm just like, that is what I aspire to, just to be out there and be open with the life that I'm living and not have any regrets. Like, I don't believe from what I've read, like she had any kind of monumental regrets of who she was as a person.
Not that I'm aware of. I think she was very comfortable with being who she was. And of course, her travels, she was of the generation, she's a little bit older than I am. Mm-hmm. And my generation, as you know, we did not travel in the same way. I visited, you know, Italy and France, you know, you do all of those things. But her generation, Jimmy, speaking of Jimmy, she and Jimmy were close. I knew Jimmy, we did, Mr. Baldwin, we did the book together, but he moved. He lived in St. Paul de Vence, and he bought a home there. My generation would never have moved. We would never leave the United States. We fought for the land that our ancestors had worked and had worked for free. So we were kind of different, and learning about the travels of her generation. And I think it was very good because it taught them something about being free that I think they passed along actually to our generation in the same way. But we were free, but we weren't leaving. We could go, but we were going to come back. And I think that was that's what changed America in the way, if I may. And I'm sorry that she's not here to help Black Lives Matter, because we were a part of the civil rights movement, and ours was a part of being in the civil part, America. But Black Lives Matter is global. And we saw that. We saw when things had happened, especially when the murder of George Floyd happened, we saw people in Australia were picketing with us. And I think that's incredibly wonderful what those young women have, and they're a little bit younger than I am, well, at least 20 years younger than I am, what they have done with their talent. And I'm a space freak, which some of you may or may not know. I just love space. I love the idea of Mars. And as you know, we have put a CD on Mars now. We're building a library on Mars. So we have one on one side of Mars, and we just put the other one there about a month ago. And I'm really very pleased about, I'm pleased that I have a poem in there. Of course, Maya does also. Dr. Robertson picked what he was going to put in there. But I'm even more pleased that this generation, this younger generation, they have now translated the library. They are in the process, I should say, of translating the library into Navajo, because Navajo is the first language that we know of here in what we call the United States. And it's so incredibly wonderful that we have taken those steps. I'm sure if Maya were with us, this is something that she would be very, very excited about. And knowing Maya, she probably speaks Navajo because she did one of everything, you know. And she could probably say, oh, Nikki, let me read this for you and do it. You know, no kemosabe here. She would get it done. And I think that's just incredible. I really do.
There's just so much. That's amazing that y'all have the, so is it a capsule on Mars? Like, what exactly did y'all put up there?
It is a library, mostly poetry. Novels are too long. Mm-hmm. It's that simple. And it's a disc like you would put in your car, or if you have an older car, for those of you who drive Mercedes Benzes or something, you can't put a disc in, but I have an old car. And so I can listen to my Ray Charles or whatever. And it's a disc that we left, and it's in a box. And we hope that in 100 years, I say we, and again, this is Dr. Robertson who created the idea, let's put a library so that in 100 years or 200 years, whomever would find themselves on Mars, whether it's us or whether it's a life form that we are unaware of now, no matter what it is, they're going to see this box. And if they open it, we're going to hope, of course, that they can speak or understand English. But Dr. Robertson finally realized, oh, let's go back to the beginning as much as we are capable. And that's what took him back to, of course, the Navajos. And he said, well, this is the oldest language on Earth. Let's translate, which is what they're in the process of doing. And I'm so proud that I'm so proud to be a part of a project that has enough sense to recognize we are not the first. And with any luck, we will not be the last. We are part of the life on this planet. And if we're lucky, we'll be a part of the life on the other. But that's what we're doing. We're building a library. Well, we're building two now on Mars. I think it's incredible. I really do.
And that's fantastic. That is so fantastic. I love that. I love that.
It's wonderful. If you're a space freak, which I am, Dr. Bolton, when he was the chair of NASA before the 45th came in and fired all the black people that he could. But Dr. Bolton and I used to have a discussion about, and Charles was a friend too, not a hangout, but a friend. But we used to have a discussion about how can you go into space without wine? It was just that simple. Just how can you go into space without wine? And we found that out by studying studying the explorers. When the Europeans started to explore the oceans, one of the things they did, and this is history, they killed each other a lot. They were in the ocean and they were by themselves, and there was a lot of murders going on. And somebody finally realized, oh, one, they need something to drink, which they need some alcohol. And two, why don't we recruit some women? And I say that with no. So when we talk about the explorers, we forget, and you, Gloria, are a well-read black girl, but we forget that there were women on those ships. And they were not just there to be used. They were a part of the exploration. They were a part of going forward. And they were also a part of the reason that we were now able to continue exploring, because they kept some sanity. Because we know from the history that without other people, we know that there were black and brown people with the white people. Now, whoever's telling the story, now let's go back to Maya for a minute. Whoever's telling the story gets to tell it their way. So if you're just hearing the story of the explorer, you would think, okay, a couple of white guys got on the ship and it was going to be really fun. They had some beautiful clothes and they went around the world and they discovered everything. But we forget that there were all kinds of people on that ship, on those ships, which kept the sanity there. And we know, of course, that Columbus was lost. So the reason that we call the Native Americans, in which they are not even that, but the reason we call them is that Columbus thought he was in India and he's just forgotten about the rest of the people. And we who are the rest of the people have a story to tell also about exploring that, whether it's Matthew Henson, and we talked about Jean-Baptiste de Sable. Where would Chicago be without that? We get to talk about how we came together. And again, having a voice, if I may, like Maya's, helped everybody to begin to understand. Yeah, everybody has been, if not every place, mentally in your heart, that that group was able, they were able to travel and to enjoy their travel, to be able to see the world there very differently. And I think that that's incredibly important. And I think that, that Maya and her group helped to make the exploration of the new world possible. We still have an exploration to go.
Would you consider yourself, the work that you did with Maya Angelou, just as being like literary icons, would you consider yourself an explorer? Is that how you would label yourself in terms of the work? Because you, I mean, I have this quote that I love from Maya Angelou, and she basically talks about the life-giving power of literature and the fact that you both, the words that you put down onto paper that went into books, that went into my hands and so many other wonderful people that took in your work, you have given us power. You've given us this idea that we can be who we want to be. And with that, you are this type of, just like this, there's a lineage happening. There's an exploration happening. There's so much, you know, whether we're on, you know, the land here or we're shooting up to Mars, we are all doing this because of your work. Like, do you feel that sense of responsibility or that sense of just like the magnitude of how your life and how Maya Angelou's life has touched so many people? I get giddy just thinking about it, because I'm just like, wow, like I'm talking to you, but I have been listening and I have studied your words for the longest time. And I know everyone listening has that same energy and has that same kind of like that epiphany in their head. Like, wow, you were here in the flesh in person, and you're so beautiful. You're so like, there's a radiance that comes from you, but you started. You know, I'm rereading Gemini. Like I've been reading your work from your 20s, and even then, like you knew it at 20. like reading that, like, I'm just like, did she know? Like, how did they know? Like they were going to be who they were going to be. Does that make sense?
I don't know. It makes sense. I think that what you do is all you can. I'm a big fan of the spirituals, mm-hmm. and the spirituals teach you so much. I'm always amazed that people don't know the spirituals. It's about 1,000 spirituals. And the one thing that you learn with the spirituals is that there's no call for vengeance. No matter what you're hearing, there's no call for vengeance. But what I also love, and it's not a spiritual, but it's just the way that those who were slaves, they're going to lose their children. They're going to be brought, and somebody's going to come and say, I'm purchasing this one, but not that one. And your child is going to go away. The same way that we have a problem on the border, that United States is splitting up, and we still are splitting up families. But what I really appreciate about, and I'm a big fan of Black women, of course, but what I really appreciate is that as they are losing that child, as that child is moving on, you wanted to tell that child who it is. So you're saying to them, if anybody asks you who you are, tell them you're a child of God. And I think it gave them the strength, that little baby girl who was pretty, who was going to be put into the sex trade. And it gave that girl back that she had not done anything wrong. She is a child of God, and she will go forward. And I've always thought about what Black women, the strength that the Black women had to have to go forward, to find a way to be, for lack of a better word, all right with themselves. That's the one thing that's so important, to be all right with yourself. And as you said, Maya taught you that. It's all right. Can you imagine a woman as tall as Maya? Because she was very tall. So you can imagine she's going to get, she wasn't going to laugh at her, going to tease her, going to have something to say about it. And that has to be back in her head. If anybody asks me who I am, I'm a child of God. And you can read it in her work, in the love of her work.
I'm with you 100%, because I do feel like there is this resilience that you need to inquire You have to be self-determined. You have to be patient and compassionate with yourself and generous with yourself. And in turn, you bring that out and that flows, overflows into other people. And if you are an artist and you're doing that in your artistry, whether it's a painting or a book or a play, like the audience, the community feels that. And I agree with you. There has to be a sense of spiritual connection with yourself and understanding where you come from. So the words, I am a child of God, are that is like the first stepping stone. You know, like you have to know where you're from. You have to understand where you stand, you know, and even in that, as you're growing and you're changing, it's okay to evolve. Like I think about the last book, your latest book, like I was, you know, you came to the festival again, we thank you so much. And reading that and reading the words that were so reflective of the current moment, talking about what was happening with 45, what happened at Virginia Tech, like your work continues to evolve and continues to embrace a new generation. And in that, I just want to say, thank you. Thank you for not leaving us behind, but just pulling us up and lifting us up as you just evolve as a beautiful artist and allowing us to give you your flowers and, you know, going into the garden is to say thank you, thank you, thank you, because I don't want to get like emotional, but it is so profound. And Maya Angelou's work did the same amount of just like deep investigation and deep love and self-reflection. And it just makes us so, so thankful, you know, like, wow, to have you here, to have like Maya Angelou here, to have all these incredible Toni Morrison, Gwendolyn Brooks, like the power, you know, like I'm always in awe. And I think that that's why I give when I'm doing the work of Well-Read Black Girl, like I'm searching for the next people, the next writers that need that same lifting, they need that same love and nurturing, because they're out there and it might be a little bit more distracting now. I would love to get your opinion on what it takes right now to kind of blossom in the environment we're in because of social media and because there's so much technology that kind of interferes with the spirit, you know, how one can be grounded. How would you recommend a poet or any artist be grounded in their work and not be distracted?
Well, I would say the first thing to any artist, no matter what you do, dance, you're an actress, no matter what it is you do, writer, the first thing you have to do is your art, because it doesn't really matter what other people think about your art. It doesn't matter how other people receive your art, especially, and I have to say especially, if you're a writer, because writers are really never, you talk about getting your flowers, writers never get their flowers until way after they're dead. And I mean, and I say that to my students all the time, just for recent, who would have thought that a diary being kept by a teenager in Germany, a little 14-year-old, 15-year-old girl named Anne Frank, would help to explain World War II? Nobody. But she kept a diary, and she wasn't trying to be impressive. She wasn't hoping that somebody read it and, you know, learned something or moved something along or changed the world. She just was trying to say, this is what happened to me today. This is what I think. And I think the sweetest thing is when she had a crush on that boy. And so despite all of these people being murdered around her, and it wasn't that she was not used to it. It wasn't, you know, she was trying to forget. It's just that she had a crush. And I think that sometimes, you know, we put pressure on people. And the reason I have such admiration for Well-Read Black Girl, and you've contacted me and I've responded to you before, because I do have such an affection for what you're doing. But what you are doing is to let people find themselves. That's what's important, to let people find themselves. You can't worry about what other people think about you. You have to let yourself find yourself. And living in a world that is so fast right now, because it is, everything that happens is just zoom, zoom, zoom. And you have to figure out how to slow the world to your pace, how you get on that train, as it were. And I think that that's incredibly important, that you figure out what you want. You don't have to make a decision. I've always hated that, by the way, Gloria. I've always hated, you know, a kid was born, practically a baby, and, oh, I wonder what he'll be. And then he starts to walk. Oh, I wonder what he'll be. And then he's in high school. Oh, I wonder what he'll be. What college are you going to go to? And you have all of this pressure. I just think it's important to let people be what they are and not put that pressure on them. What are you going to be when you grow up? You don't be when you grow up. Every day is the same. You don't have another. Every day is today. And that's the day you want to live with. That's the day you want to have. And you want to be the best person that you can be for yourself today. Today is what you have. So you have to use today.
Thank you for that reminder of being present and being still with our thoughts and not trying to compete with everything that is moving on around us, because at the end of the day, it is, you're with yourself. You're with your own thoughts, you're with your own mind, and you have to be able to be silent and sit still and do the work that you want to put out in the world. And I've been talking to so many folks in our community just about the craft, right? Like this is essential to anything you want to do. You got to study it. You got to practice it. You have to be really good with failing and then getting back up. Right now, my little boy is walking, and every time he falls, I'm just like applauding him, because I'm like, okay, you're falling, but you're going to get back up, and then you're going to be able to take more steps and more steps and more steps. And I want him to feel comfortable with failure. I want him to be able to like know that he has family and folks that love him. So anytime he does fall down, people are going to rally up and lift him back up. And that is so important with art too, you know, like, because it's not always going to be well received. I think of, you know, the great Audre Lorde. We look at her work and people are quoting her left, right, and center. But at the time, she was not as popular. People weren't, you know, racing to applaud her work. It took years for people to see the reflection of what she was doing at the present moment. And I think like that is what we have to remember, that it might not be well received at the moment, but if you are dedicated to your work, years from now, it will find the audience and it will be uplifted. That's a hard thing for me to say, because sometimes I'm like, why should it be that way? People should recognize it at that moment. Like, people should have known that what Zora Neale Hurston was doing then, you know, but I guess that's just how it happens. Everything takes time and patience with yourself, and also patience to know that what you're doing means something and it can't be like thrown away. You know, if you're putting your heart and your hard work into it, it can't be thrown away.
No, of course not. But you have to remember that there was a time that so-called intelligent people, the men who were supposed to be intelligent, thought the world was flat.
Right.
There was a big argument about that. The world was flat. And everybody said, no, I think the world is round. No, it's flat. So, you know, if you're ever thinking, nobody understands me, or this will never, just remember that there were some people who used to think that the world is flat. So we've moved along and you're moving along. And one day what you're doing will be a part of that understanding, that no, not just that the world is round, but there's a galaxy out there. Well, see, I'm into Mars. And people ask me all the time, well, aren't you afraid if you went to Mars, you know, aren't you afraid that there'd be some aliens there and they might eat you? I said, oh, sweetie, I live with aliens. I'm in the United States. I have aliens. So aliens are right here. I'm used to aliens. So that's why I keep saying to the young Black women, particularly, you got to go into space, because you're the only people on Earth used to aliens. That's the truth. We live with them every day and have to find a way through it.
Have you had a conversation with Mae Jemison or any astronaut? We got to have you in a conversation with a recent astronaut immediately.
I did have when Mae Jemison came back, I interviewed her for Essence magazine.
Oh, and that's incredible.
Yeah. Oh, I had to have, as I said to the editor of Essence, and this was a very, you know, I said, I'm going to say this slow and I'm going to say it loud so that you'll understand it. Either I interview Mae Jemison or I'm going to cut your head off. You choose. what did Vito say? You know, I'm going to make you an offer. You cannot refuse.
So, take it or leave it, right?
So I did. I interviewed May. And I just think it's so wonderful because we want to see more, especially more women. And we're beginning to see more women. And it's not that we're excluding men. It's just that we need to see more of everybody taking a step into the galaxy in which we live. And if anybody asks you who you are, tell them you're a child of God. But now you are also going to have to answer, I am from the third planet of the yellow sun. And it's going to make more sense. We're going to have to take those steps because you can't say I'm from Chicago or I'm from Virginia, because that won't make any sense to any living thing. We have to find a way to define ourselves within the galaxy that the galaxy can understand. And that means we have to respect the galaxy. Well-read Black girls know this because they have been reading and they have begun to see that sun that tells us something different, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's amazing. Sort of in that same vein of, you mentioned a little bit like this, the collective we of, and Gloria, you mentioned it in your book too, in the introduction, the authentic and captivating stories created by these authors have been passed down from one generation of Black women to the next and the next. In reading them myself, getting to know them in my own way, their books and profound literary legacy have become my inheritance, which I love. And I think that encapsulates what we've been talking about. And I wonder, where obviously we know Maya Angelou falls in that line of inheritance, if you will. But who are some of the writers before her that inspired her? We mentioned Paul Laurence Dunbar as well, but I'm curious if there are any other writers that she read a lot or encountered at certain parts in her life that shaped her own writing.
Well, I would certainly imagine she knew Langston. So we know that she's going to read Langston Hughes and James Baldwin. We know that. I would imagine she also read Nella Larson, Alain Locke, who put together the Harlem Renaissance. I mean, he really was he's at the helm of that, and he brought together so many of the young writers, and he had so much faith in them. And I don't know, I'm sorry to say, I don't remember if Maya ever knew Alain Locke. She would have been young, and she certainly wouldn't have read, she would have read the anthologies. She would have heard some things about him. I know that in Harlem, there was a bookstore, and we all miss it, called Michaud's Bookstore. It was at 125th Street and 7th Avenue. And if you ever wanted anybody, you wanted to meet anybody, to run into anybody, if you just hung out at Michaud's long enough, you would run into him. And I know that she knew the work of Paul Marshall, of course, who was a novelist and a very sweet person. I can't tell you who influenced her how. I know that Dunbar influenced her because I know Why the Caged Bird Sings is his poem. I would imagine that County Cullen had a bit of, if not a great deal, actually. County Cullen was quite brilliant. So I would imagine that he had some influence. But of all of them, I would imagine, this is me imagining, that Langston had the most because she and Langston were contemporaries. And, you know, you could see both of them sitting down and, I mean, no disrespect here, but, you know, she drank bourbon, you know, and you could see them sitting down, you know, having their, she drank scotch. And you could see them sitting around having a drink and discussing some of these people. So I don't know the influence per se as much as the intelligence, that they had the intelligence to embrace the writers that are coming coming a bit before them.
I would also say, and again, this is like a educated guess from just like reading her works and studying it. I would highly agree with Paul Marshall. I would also say like Rosa Guy, you know, the folks that all congregated and communed with the Harlem's Writers Guild, you know, like they did so much work together and writing together, you know, during a bourbon, scotch together, you know, and we talked about it before, like the cooking, the food, the you know, sharing a meal, like all that comes together in the art, like that building of community. And she seems to have this enormous community of folks that like really, not only were they having a good time together, but they were really doing the work and like perfecting their crafts together. So I think about the Harlem Writers Guild a lot and the sister circles they probably had when they were writing and trying to figure out the work, you know, workshopping their stuff. I absolutely adore Rosa Guy's work so much and take a lot of inspiration from her community building as well, because they were politically aligned with their work and made it very clear about where they like stood when it came to just like Black art and Black politics, you know? I would add that, but it is such a profound thing to have, to just be able to study. Like I was actually, I have an old copy of The Heart of a Woman. And I thought that there would be, like, isn't that amazing? Her face is so beautiful. Like, I found it at like an old, like a thrift store. But I thought at the bottom, I thought there would be acknowledgments in it. So I was kind of like, oh, let me read the acknowledgments and like see who, like, you know, she mentioned, but there's no acknowledgments in this copy. So was that like a thing? Did acknowledgments come up? Is that like a new thing? And back in the day, did you write acknowledgments in the book? I guess not. But anyway.
You know who we haven't mentioned because we've been talking so much about the women, but I really do want to mention because I know that they were close. John Oliver Killens.
And John, yes.
John and Maya were very close. They were They were good friends. Barbara, his daughter, is still with us. I don't know if his son is still with us or not, but John and Maya were very close. And I think that John had a lot to do with helping and saying to Maya, go ahead, you can do it. Go ahead, you can do it. And John, and you mentioned Rosa Guy, of course, but Rosa has not gotten the attention that she deserves, but neither has John.
Yeah. And I feel like if you're one that's studying like Black art, Black literature, those names are, I mean, they are mega. Like you cannot even study this work without uttering their names because they had such influence in terms of their writing, first of all, but again, like that community building, like I think of his work of, I mean, all the anthologies I've referenced or read it, that's him, you know? But I agree with you when it comes to like the quote unquote mainstream knowledge, you know, like those folks aren't fully aware of their impact and that should be rectified for sure.
Yeah. As I say, writers, we're so, you know, you just have to assume that 100 years from now, somebody will read you. But Chester Hines wrote the mystery novels, and those were all fun. And I knew Chester. We would hang out together when he was in the States. He spent a lot of time, you know, in Russia when we were still friends with Russia, and a lot of time in jail for another reason. But, it didn't mean anything to me. But Chester was a good friend. He's from Ohio, so the Ohio people, have really come together. And I think that's good too. If you like mystery, it's not murder mysteries like, oh my, you know, there's some of that. I can't read some of that stuff that is on television. I can't bear that violence. So he would have those nice, like Miss Marple or, you know, Agatha Christie kind of murders. You go like, yeah, that's really great. And you sit there trying to figure out. I love Chester Himes. He was a good friend. And I love what he was doing with the literature. But again, this is something that you don't know, Chester, and I'm not, you know, this is not a correction. This is just, you can't know them all because it takes time. And so you begin to learn, you know, you take a step and you take a step and you take a step. And if you're not busy, you can go to Mars and sit and see what the library has in it.
I love that. Well, you know, the reason I really started to study John Oliver Killens is because he created the it's called the National Black Writers Conference. And that's, and especially if you're from, you know, New York, that's based at Megger Evans College over in Brooklyn, you know. So it is like this all connect, like all these connections. His work is just so phenomenal. And he taught creative writing at Howard. I went to Howard. He taught it at, I want to say Columbia as well. Like he definitely has a huge imprint. And I'm not as familiar with Chester's work, but it's this thing that like we should definitely have almost like this literary encyclopedia where we can reference all these things and look it up. You know, technology does have its advantages. So you can Google things and you can look in the archives. One of my favorite things to do is use JSTOR, which is like this incredible archive of journals, and you can look up old journals like the Negro Digest or the Black Scholar. Like I love going to estate sales and trying to find all those like vintage things and, you know, hold them in your hand, smell the paper, look at the old ads and things. And like, it's amazing. It offers so much inspiration, but it also gives a blueprint of how they organize and how like they were able to use their literary criticism, use their writings and their creative works to also just help shape identity, you know, like everyone, like folks are using the word identity politics all over the place now, but those are like the origins of those places. It's like, okay, we need to create this work because folks need to read it and interact with it and engage with it in a real way. And it's made for us. It's not made for anybody else. It's like, we are doing it because we want to create this work and create spaces for ourselves.
Yeah. Well, of course, now you're talking about Negro Digest, David Lawrence, who's a Chicagoan.
Yes.
And Lerone Bennett. And these were all friends and really wonderful, wonderful people. And putting Johnson publication, and I think that people didn't realize, and that's speaking of criticism, how important Ebony magazine. Now he's going to do Jet. And if Jet hadn't done but one thing, it would have been worth it. They put the photograph of Emmett Till on the cover. And that changed. That changed America. Nobody could look at it. But he did Ebony, and Ebony had to, in looking at Ebony magazine, all of a sudden companies, Coca-Cola for one, and I'm proud that they are boycotting, that they are having something to say about what's going on in Georgia now. But Coca-Cola, all of a sudden they realized, oh, Black people, I don't think we were called Black people then, drink Coca-Cola. So they started taking ads. And he's the one that opened up. When we look at magazines now, you have to give Mr. Johnson credit. And he had, of course, you know, Ebony, and he had Negro Digest, which is going to be a part of the same, you know, of Reader's Digest, because he's going to take the readers. And David Lawrence had a lot to do with that. And then, of course, Jet. And Jet was the little magazine. And Jet was incredibly, every week you wanted to know what's on Jet. I made the cover of Jet, and I was just walking on air. Oh yeah, I was just like, oh wow. You know, I was so thrilled. I can't begin to tell you. And there's a lot to learn, and then there's a lot to enjoy. And so some of the learning is enjoyable. And I think that, again, we have to keep that in mind. It's not a burden on our shoulders. It's just something like, oh, I think I'll look at, you know what I miss, and then I'll let you go because I'm over talking my time, I'm sure. I really miss libraries that had, and you guys understand what you're doing now better than I do, but I miss the little library cards that you could go through. And so many things came up that you didn't know. And if I understood this thing that we do, the way we're talking now, if I understood what this is, computer and webinar and the things that, if I understood that better, I would probably be spending just days going through as you're doing with certain, you know, looking for certain books and finding certain things. It's so wonderful. It really, really is just the newness of it. And you want to, you say, oh, I'm looking for, I was recently, I found it though. I was looking for a book, I Too Sing America by Will Hagrid. And you know, you're looking for a book, and you can find it. It's there someplace, and you got to go out. You know, I live in a museum, and my bedroom is a jungle because my mom died, you know, 13 years ago, and I have flowers. I had from the flowers that those that didn't bloom, you have the vines, and I brought them home and stuck them in water, and of course, not of course, luckily, they have grown and they have grown and they have grown. So between the books, you can't see, but you can see around me. Between the books and the pictures and that jungle in my bedroom, one day somebody will come through and they say, oh, I didn't know she'd been dead. I wonder how long, because that's the truth. It'll be all right. I'll have a smile on my face.
We are so thankful for you. And I would love to be a fly in that room. Because I know you have, just even looking at this beautiful, you and the Zoom, like it just is all your photos and just the memorabilia. Like it just feels like looking at you, look, you are at home, you look comfortable and it looks just like a warm, loving place. So thank you for just spending time with us and sharing these memories of Maya Angelou and giving us encouragement. And even giving us hints to look up other folks like Chester and John and just all these amazing people that need to be part of our conversation, like constantly. Like we don't have, I wouldn't say we don't have the luxury of forgetting, but also I want to repeat what you said is the joys in the learning. Like there's so much joy to be found in their work and to be celebrated.
Thank you. I think so, for sure.
Yeah. That was beautiful. I know I'm definitely going to make a reading list to accompany this podcast when we share it. So that's for sure. I have one more question. If we're not over, I'm curious. So this is kind of also comes from, you know, personally for me. I was talking to the Glory earlier. I have a nephew and two nieces of mixed race, and they're the oldest one. The nephew just turned 10, so they're all 10 years or younger, and. When Glory came, when Well Read Black Girl came out a couple of years ago now, I picked up this book, Well Read Black Girl, because I'm, you know, knowing for my nieces. And I'm just wondering if either of you have any bit of advice or any message to young Black girls who are starting the journey of self-discovery right now.
I'm just going to say, I think that there should be joy. And I think that your nieces and people like me or anybody else, I think that we all have our myths, and they will lose their myths. They will. I mean, there's no question about it. You're talking about your son, and one day on his three-wheeler, you're going to take that third wheel away. I didn't let my son, I have a son, and people would say that, you know, aren't you going to get him a three-wheeler? I said, hell no. He's going to fall and pick up the bike and go on. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to waste my money on it. And everybody wants, there's some myth that everybody has that, and they lived happily ever after. My parents were their marriage was crazy. And if you ask me, and I've said that, if you ask me what I was doing at 11 o'clock Saturday night, I was listening to my father hit my mother. So you're not going to live happily ever after. You're going to learn to adjust, and you're going to make that adjustment, and you're going to do what you have to do. And I hope that your nieces, I hope that they are going to be happy, but they're not mixed race. They're human. And it's time that we started using that. We are all human race. And so the color has gone up. The color was about politics and it hasn't worked. It's old and it's old fashioned and it's led us to so many wars, and we just need to quit that. They're your nieces and you love them. That's it. That's not hard. And I hope that they have some books that they enjoy. And if they enjoy it, they do. But if they don't, they say, Daddy, Uncle, I don't want to read this now. No big deal. No big deal, because eventually they'll have to live with something. There is pain, but there is also pleasure. Life is wonderful. And a part of what we do in life is we live. And I have my students right now, their question for the week, because I'm at Virginia, I still teach, I don't know, they're going to fire me one day. But their question was time, because everybody's heard it, you and I, you've heard it, you know, don't waste your time on him, don't waste your time on her, don't waste your time on this. Well, who knows how much time I have? And if that is wasted, what do you know that I don't know? Because I didn't think I was wasting my time. I thought I was using the time that I have with this person or with that project or with whatever. And you hear people say that don't waste your time. Well, I don't know who they think they are, but whoever they think they are, it's my time. So I need to be left alone. I'm a big girl.
I will just echo the idea of being self-determined and understanding that, you know, as Nikki said, time is, it's your time and you get to create the life that you want to live and use the time you want to, you know, use it wisely, but it isn't one to be, you don't have to like live up to anyone else's standards, like be yourself. Like I think throughout this whole conversation, I've just been thinking about how Nikki Giovanni is 100% herself. And I, Gloria Edom, and I try to move in a space where I'm 100% myself and we can meet and we can, you know, enjoy things, but we can also have discourse, we can disagree, but that doesn't take it away from who we are. And I think I'm trying my best to instill that in my little one. And I know as an uncle, you're sharing that with the girls, letting them, you know, be themselves and not limit themselves in any way, you know, and using books and art and other things out in the world for them to inspire, like nature, like get them outside. Like I remember, this is so random, but I went to summer camp one year. I was probably around like 10 or 11. And my mom let me climb this hill. Like I thought I was hiking. I really thought like I climbed this massive hill. And then I went to it again when I was older, like in my 20s. It was so small. It was like not even a real hike. Like I probably just like ran up it in 5 minutes. But because my mom let me go by myself and I had my little stick, I thought I was like, you know, I thought I was on Mount Everest, you know, but it gave me so much confidence but she still like patted me in a way where I wouldn't hurt myself, but she let me go by myself. And I think like we can do those things where kids don't have to face like really hardship or like, crazy adversity, but we can give them space to be independent and test things out and mess up a little bit, but still have like a little bit of a cushion, you know? Because in some spaces, I definitely had experiences that were really adversity, like were really hard times. But because I had earlier experiences where I was able to risk things and be okay, when the hard things came, I knew how to face them. And I was like, okay, I can get through this because I got through that other thing when I was 11, you know? So giving them space to have that. And I am definitely still figuring that out, but I know it helped. I look back at what my mom did and I'm like, oh, wow, she really did give me a lot of opportunities to make my own choices or wear my own clothes. Or even like, my parents are Nigerian and most Nigerian parents are just like, you need to become a doctor and a lawyer. The fact that I'm in a creative space is like all because of my mom. You know, she just was like, you can do whatever you want. And she still was stern in some areas, but for the most part, she was like, okay, that's what you want to do. If you can put a roof over your head, you can do it. And she didn't make me like my dad was like, take the LSAT just in case. And I did. But like, I didn't do, like, I passed, but I didn't become a lawyer. So, you know, just giving them options and opportunities to be them best selves. And when things are scary, like they can come to Uncle Nate and say things and not be judged either. Because that's a whole other thing when kids feel like they're being judged, that's not a good feeling. So you could be like, I'm an open book, come through, talk to me. I'm not going to make a face, you know? I don't know if this is going to be in the podcast, but I hope that helps with your nieces.
No, definitely, yeah. Helps me regardless, so. Well, I wanted to give you both one last chance. Was there anything else you wanted to share about Maya Angelou and how, you know, how she has impacted your life or your careers or your writing? Or any favorite passages or anything that you want to share of hers?
Read something. You want me to read something?
Yeah, I love that.
Okay, hold on, let me, because I did pull something up. Anytime I'm doing an anthology or doing any kind of essay collection, I note her work because, she has been so influential. And so I have a second anthology coming out in October, and it focuses all on Black girlhood through the lens of short story. And so this, like during 2020, that's all I did. I was like reading so many short stories. I read all of Toni K. Bambara. And then I just read so many short stories because I was trying to figure out which ones to put in the collection. But as I was going through, I found this amazing quote that kind of really summed up what I was saying earlier, that life-giving power of literature. So it says here, When I look back, I am so impressed again with the life-giving power of literature. If I were a young person today trying to gain a sense of myself in the world, I would do that again by reading, just as I did when I was young. And I like that was for me, I was like, that's the essence of the Well-Read Black Girl organization. It's just like reading to find yourself, to reflect on the works of Black women and non-binary writers, to really just kind of sit with it. And even when you don't understand it, because that will happen, to still being patient and sitting with it and allow yourself to grow. You know, like I can't tell you how many times I had to reread Toni Morrison. And so, like, but you know, eventually it does hit you and you get something and you understand the language, you know, evolves as you evolve. And so I would just, that quote, I have that at the very top of the introduction in my new anthology, because I was like, yes, like reading. That's what Maya Angelou would do. That's what I would do too. Just like reading, allowing the words give me power and sustenance.
I couldn't agree more. We also have to remember that she could sing. So she did Porgy and Bess once, remember? Well, I shouldn't say remember. You were probably, you were way too young, might not even have been born. But she did Porgy and Bess. And I think that Maya tried to do everything that interested her. And that's what I would say to everybody. Whatever it is that interests you, do it. And eventually it works one way or the other. I'm not a fan of mistakes, because mistakes are just something that you learned. So whatever if 1 + 1 = 4, then if that's not right, then you've learned something. 1 + 1 = 2. That's a learning. You see what I'm saying? And I think that's what's important. And I've enjoyed the friendship. And I did. I have enjoyed. I shouldn't say did. Because in a way, once you have a friend, you always have. There's some part. And I have enjoyed the friendship of Maya. And I will always remember and always say that I appreciate the way that she always went out of her way to be kind to my mother.
That is so beautiful. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Wow. Yeah. Thanks again for both of you for being here. It truly has been an honor, and I've learned a lot. So our listeners will too. So I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. This series continues next month with a new episode airing May 26th. If you wish to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, explore our virtual exhibit, American Voices, now available at nationofwriters.org. Again, that is nationofwriters.org. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.